Welcome to this forum about the proposed amendment to the Virginia Constitution that's on our ballots this year. I'm Bob McGrath, a director of Senior Statesmen of Virginia, a nonpartisan organization founded almost 25 years ago now, with a mission to help make a better informed citizenry about public policy or political issues. In normal times, our meetings happen once a month at the center in Charlottesville. In this pandemic time, we have to do things virtually like so many other organizations. If you're not yet a member of Senior Statesmen, please check out our website. It has records of all past programs and also information about how easy it is to join our organization. Now, I'm going to do a screen share here, so bear with me just a minute. I want to go ahead now, so I think you should see the screen share. In Virginia, members of the General Assembly establish electoral districts for legislative and congressional seats every 10 years after the census. Senior Statesmen of Virginia hosted a program way back in 2014 featuring Terry Cooper and Lee Middleditch, two of the founders of a nonpartisan organization called One Virginia 2021. The goal was to get political redistricting out of the hands of the elected politicians. And to do that requires amending the Virginia Constitution. Their presentation featured some dramatic examples of contorted, gerrymandered district shapes. It seemed at the time that getting the General Assembly to approve the amendment to the Constitution for the required two successive sessions before sending it to we, the voters, was a very high hurdle. Well, as we know, that's all happened, and a proposed amendment is now on our ballots. Democrats now control both houses of the General Assembly, but it's Democrats, by and large, themselves, who are most strongly divided about whether or not the proposed amendment ought to pass. We're pleased to have Brian Cannon and Chris Ambrose with us today to speak for and against the proposed amendment. To introduce them, Chris is a small business owner from Fairfax County. He's been a longtime community activist and advocate against gerrymandering. He supports independent redistricting and is a founding member of Fair Districts Virginia, a PAC that supports independent redistricting but opposes the amendment. Ryan Cannon is the executive director of Fair Maps Virginia, a PAC dedicated to educating Virginians about the amendment and supports its passage. He was the executive director of the organization I mentioned before, One Virginia 2021, for a number of years. He has two degrees, a bachelor's and a law degree from William & Mary. Now, what we're going to do is Brian and Chris will each make opening statements for up to 8 minutes and then closing statements of up to 4 minutes. And in between, we'll hopefully have time for a lot of Q&A. So please send your questions in via the Q&A facility on Zoom. Now, in my notes, I said by coin flip, somebody will go first, but we haven't actually had time to do the coin flip. So you guys, I'm going to flip a coin, and I say that Brian is going to go first. And then in the summary, Chris will go first, okay? And finally, this is like a soccer game. I have a yellow card and I have a red card. And so you get the yellow card when you've got a minute to go on your 8 minute opening statement. And then the red card means you're ejected. Okay. So Brian, go ahead.
Thank you all. Thank you for having this discussion and for engaging in it with us. Thank you also for engaging in this way before this issue was even cooled back in 2014 with Lee Middleditch and the late Terry Cooper, who helped get this organization off the ground. And credit to them, because they and the other folks that got One Virginia 2021 started back in 2013 and 2014. I mean, it was a long shot on a good day that we would get reform. And what we... And we were in the we were just in the wake of having, you know, the 2011 gerrymander, which was a big mistake, and a big mess. And a lot of reformers didn't even want to pick up the flag again and carry it forward. And to Lee Middleditch's credit, and through mostly sheer force of Lee Middleditch, whom I'm sure you all know, we did that and got it up and running. I'm the second executive director. I came on board in January of 2015. And we've had a lot of lessons learned over the course of this 7-year road here in Virginia on this iteration of reform. Reform's hard. Amending the Constitution, though we do it all the time in Virginia, amending the Constitution to take the power away from legislators is really hard. And that's the kind of challenge we faced. Fortunately, however, this issue has started to bubble up as one of the kind of good government issues. It reminds me similarly to how when I was in high school in the 1990s, that the campaign finance discussion was starting to really bubble up with John McCain running for president, things like that, and talking about kind of both sides and the corruption of money in there. This is a similar vibe, whereas, you know, this is a real good government issue. And what I think you'll hear from Chris as well is that we're both against gerrymandering. The question is, how do we get there? Here's what I do know. In Virginia, we had a perfect storm. In 2019, in the General Assembly session, which was the last time to pass an amendment through the legislature to start the process to get it on the ballot before 2021. In 2019, the Republicans held a 21-19 and a 51-49 majority in both the Senate and the House, respectively. They had previously opposed redistricting. There's a handful of Republicans who have been excellent on this issue for a long, long time, but the majority of their leadership was not among them. And so what happened in 2019 is the Democrats came and introduced a reform in the Senate. The Republicans introduced an amendment, or a similar reform in the House, and the Democratic one won out. The Democratic one was originally come up with. The framework of it was Senator George Barker and Senator Dick Sasslaw out of Fairfax. And it really was a perfect storm. Senator Sasslaw was probably encouraged to get on the right side of this issue because he had a really tough primary challenger coming that June. And the House Republicans, on the flip side, were encouraged to come to the table and set fair redistricting in 2019, because during the legislative session, the court ruled on the racially gerrymandered House of Delegates districts and adopted the map that was going to be that's in place now, but that was obviously going to lead to a number of Democratic pickups because it was unracially gerrymandering Hampton Roads and Richmond. So the Republicans, with a bare majority, saw the writing on the wall and passed this Democratic proposal from the state Senate of redistricting reform. And it was kind of the perfect storm of Democrats weren't in the majority yet, and Republicans saw that they weren't going to be in there for very much longer. Certainly, then an intervening election in November, the Democrats take back control, a narrow majority in the Senate for them, and a 55-seat majority in a 100-member House in the House for the Democrats. It passes the Senate again 38-2, but instead of passing the House with 85 votes like it did in 2019, and now it passes the House with 54 votes. So what happened? The policy didn't change. The amendment was the same in 2019 and February, March, April, May, all through the year. But we didn't really start hearing serious opposition from Democratic leadership until after the November election. Now, that being said, there are some notable exceptions to that. Delegate Price, Delegate Aird, several prominent members have been outspoken against it in 2019. And in 2020, and still to this day, and that's credit for consistency. But a lot of folks flipped on this. And so here's what this is. And I would say on an absolute scale of redistricting reform, if you're grading it, I'm a former high school government teacher, I would give this about a B, right? It's not everything I want. It's not an A or an A-plus like California or Michigan. It's a B, which is good compared to the F that I think we would get right now for our current process. So the commission is a hybrid commission of half legislators and half citizens, evenly balanced by party, and you need a supermajority of each of those to pass a map. That supermajority requirement and the partisan balance and the other checks built into the process structurally end partisan gerrymandering. It's a balanced bipartisan commission, and one of the biggest features of it is that it's transparent. For the first time ever, there's no smoky back room. All the data and all the meetings will be open and in the public, so we'll be able to watch. So I think those alone are huge steps. There's an additional step forward in this amendment as well, which is that it actually would make racial gerrymandering illegal for the first time under Virginia's constitution. It's illegal already at the federal level because of the twin kind of guardrails of the Voting Rights Act and the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause. But we were putting those similar protections into Virginia's constitution as a standalone provision for the first time ever. So I think that's an important step for Virginia to take, and long overdue, considering we've had two maps this past decade struck down as racial gerrymanders. So that's the framework of the amendment. The way to make it better would be to get rid of the legislators from the commission, right? That's the easy way to make it better. And I really, really, really want that, but it is not possible right now. We don't have the votes. We don't have the votes in the House, even with the Democrats in control. We don't have the votes in the Senate, no matter who's in control. So I would like to get better, but it's just the votes just aren't there for that right now. And the way you can see it is any reforms that were better that Democrats in the House proposed this year when they were in control, none of them got to the floor of the House of Delegates. One was killed in rules, and the other was modified to a hybrid commission structure that we have now in subcommittee. So the problem with alternative proposals to this is that bills cannot change the Constitution. That you need the Constitution currently says the legislature shall establish the districts. That's a problem. We've got to change the Constitution. Anything short of that, anything, any bill or anything else like that that comes along would only create an advisory commission next year. And I think that's what we're struggling with, is that advisory commission would have no teeth, and we'd have no guarantee of transparency. And so I think there's risks in anything we do in redistricting, but I think the risks are way lower in this. And you don't have to believe the guy who's paid for the Vote Yes campaign, who's worked on this issue for years. Don't have to believe anything I say. Don't believe anything Democratic delegates or anybody says. But look to all the experts, and all the national good government reform groups are unanimously behind this. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks, Brian. Chris, please tell us why we shouldn't vote for it.
Okay. Thank you all for having me today. And I just want to say, start off by saying, I have been a long time critic of gerrymandering since pretty much since I was a kid. I mean, I've been interested in politics since I was a kid, and I've always thought gerrymandering is just such a perversion of how the system should work. And it's obviously gotten much, much worse in recent years with all the sophisticated data and computer modeling and so on. So it's a problem that obviously needs to be addressed. So as far as the amendment itself is concerned, there's a number of flaws in it, and I'll talk about it. But the core thing is it does not end gerrymandering. What it does is it seeks to trade one type of gerrymandering for another. So it focuses on, I mean, the bottom line is it does not remove the legislators from the process. It leaves the legislators firmly in control of the redistricting process. As Brian pointed out, the ideal solution is a commission independent of the legislature. I mean, that's the whole point, right, is to get the legislature out of drawing the districts and out of picking the voters. That's the point. So that's what you ultimately need to try to get to. So what did this – that was something that One Virginia 2021 was pushing for years, and I was on board with it, and many people were, including a lot of the Democrats that are now very concerned about this. But what happened when the 2019 amendment passed, which, by the way, to be fair to the people who, quote, switched their vote, they only had about 45 minutes to review it in 2019 because it was it was introduced at the last minute. And the amendment eliminated the concept of an independent commission. Instead, it created a commission made up of eight sitting legislators and eight citizens that are effectively picked by the legislators. Now, they're technically picked by retired judges. So that was you know, the sponsor's effort to make this look like it was some kind of an independent process. They're picked by retired judges, but the retired judges can only pick the names put forward by the legislators. So it is controlled by the legislators, and the sponsor was very insistent on that provision so that they could retain that level of control. Then the other problem is that the amendment removed any anti-gerrymandering criteria from the text of the amendment. Instead, the legislature controls the criteria that the commission, which is controlled by the legislature, draws the districts by. So I actually agree with Brian that in this political environment, it's probably impossible to get the legislators out of it and get a truly, totally independent commission of citizens picked independently and drawing the districts independently. That would be the ideal. That's the perfect. But I hear a lot of people saying we're letting the perfect, the critics of this are letting the perfect be the enemy of the good. The perfect would be an independent commission. Compromise would be giving legislators a seat at the table. Significant compromise might be giving them half the seats at the table, half of the control of the commission. But what this amendment does, it gives them half of the commission, it lets them pick the other half of the commission, and then it lets them set the criteria. I mean, remember, it lets the majority party in the General Assembly set the criteria for how the districts are drawn. That is not compromise. That is capitulation to legislators that want to continue to pick their voters rather than the other way around. So those are the problems with it, but you don't have to take my word for it. And this was the key thing that made me decide to come out against it, because as Brian knows, I was back and forth. I mean, I didn't like this amendment at all when it was working its way through the General Assembly. But the question he always said to me is, if it passes, are you still going to support it? And I wasn't 100% sure, because it's just so badly flawed. But the thing that really finally made me decide not to support it and to come out against it was when I compared it to New Jersey's system, which is it's modeled after New Jersey. So that system has results in among the least competitive districts in the country. So what you've got is in Virginia, and they're a good comparison because Virginia and New Jersey can have their elections on the same cycle. And so so what happened is in New Jersey, you've got I don't know if you can hear this, but my neighbor is power washing their house. I hope that's not coming across on this. It's distracting me though. So in Virginia and New Jersey, which hold their elections right in the same cycle, so it's a very good comparison. Over the past decade, nearly three times as many incumbents have been defeated in Virginia as in New Jersey. And the turnout in New Jersey elections is routinely below 20% because elections don't make a difference. There's a group in New Jersey, Fair Districts New Jersey, aligned with a lot of other groups that have been trying for years to overturn that system. But they acknowledge it's almost an impossible task because it entrenches the incumbents. So while, yes, this system changes it a little bit because it creates a bipartisan commission. So that's true. It's got legislators from both parties, and that's something that I will acknowledge. So it takes some of the edges off of partisan gerrymandering, although it doesn't totally eliminate it. But it just replaces it with bipartisan gerrymandering. So what happens is, I mean, look at it this way. Do we really want our one act of bipartisanship out of our legislators to be when they get together once every 10 years, sit down, trade voters across party lines, and then shake hands, congratulating each other that they'll be in office for another 10 years, and they'll go back to fighting and bickering, not getting anything done, knowing full well that they'll never be held accountable for it. They're solid in their districts and so on. That's how it works in New Jersey. I don't know why we want to make that mistake here. Now, a lot of people who recognize these flaws say, well, we'll fix it later. We'll pass another amendment to fix it. But here's the problem. We look at things like, say, the Electoral College. Okay, we can pass an amendment to fix that, right? Well, not really, because the states that would have to ratify that amendment have a vested interest in the Electoral College. So it's like impossible to change. And that's what New Jersey is finding out about this. Once you give both parties the ability to ensure that their districts are safe, you've got incumbents entrenched like never before, and you'll never really be able to fix it. That's the problem. It's also telling that the Brian brought up the 2011 gerrymander. Well, the sponsor of the amendment is the architect of the 2011 gerrymander, and the other key advocate of it, the majority leader, is also complicit in that. So you have to wonder why all of the legislators who campaigned, not all, but the legislators who campaigned for reform and have advocated for reform, a lot of them did switch after they had a chance to actually read the amendment, because they never had a chance to read it the first time. And now they're against it, but the hardest fighting people for it are generally the ones who gerrymandered. It also doesn't really address the racial gerrymandering. It puts into the Constitution that they need to follow the Voting Rights Act. That's good. It's better than nothing. But the Voting Rights Act is legislation that's already there, and they already have to follow the Voting Rights Act under federal law, maybe not under state law, but it's kind of a detail. Not to mention the fact that the Voting Rights Act has been under assault and could be repealed or could be overturned in the future. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris. You audience members, please use the Q&A facility to ask us questions. We have one that I see already, and this is from John McCauley. And the question is, what criteria, if any, would the commission be free to use in determining the legislative districts? So please, both of you, ask that. Did you hear the question okay?
Yeah.
Anyway, Chris, you want to go first?
Sure. In fact, it's a good question. It was one of the things I mentioned was that there was a criteria bill. I don't know if I mentioned there was a bill that was passed, I did point out that the amendment allows the General Assembly to set the criteria. And so there was a criteria bill, SB 1255, that was passed by the Democratic-controlled General Assembly. And it actually is pretty good. It sets some decent criteria. It bans the use of partisan data in drawing districts and so on. So it's got some good things in it. The good news is that's legislation is in effect whether the amendment passes or not. So 2021, we're in pretty good shape for it. Now, obviously, it's not perfect. There are definitely issues that can only be fixed with a constitutional amendment. But 1255 takes us a long way. I mean, there is no perfect solution, really. So, we've got this amendment that's flawed, and even the advocates admit needs to be replaced immediately. And we've got a criteria bill. So that criteria bill would govern the process, as you say. But you've also got to remember that criteria bill could then be repealed by a future General Assembly that won and set criteria that would actually benefit their party, as opposed to the criteria bill that was passed in this one. That's the reason we got to take the General Assembly totally out of this process.
Thanks, Chris. Brian.
So a no vote keeps the General Assembly completely in control of the process, and they have all the legislative privilege to protect what they do and to have us not see into it. So I wish a no vote could get us more. I'd be for a no vote if it could get us more. It's just not on the table. As far as the civil rights protections, I disagree with Chris. There is a recitation in the amendment itself that says that districts shall be drawn in accordance with state and federal laws. And then it lists a couple federal laws, including the Voting Rights Act, 14th Amendment. But it also then says districts shall be drawn where practicable to allow racial and ethnic minority communities to elect a candidate of their choice. And that's an independent sentence in that paragraph. And that's early in the paragraph. And it's really important. And if we look at whether the Princeton Gerrymandering Project or one of the leading redistricting experts in the country, Professor Justin Levitt, who was in the Obama DOJ as a voting rights lead attorney. They've both said those are historic and important protections. And that it puts up the two guardrails of the against cracking in terms of the elect a candidate of their choice and against packing in terms of the where practicable language.
Okay, thanks. Brian. We have another question from Tom Cross. Please define the problem to be fixed. What does ideal districting look like? How far away are we from that? And what states reflect the ideal? Brian, you want to go first?
Sure. The problem is right now that we have legislative districts drawn to reflect an incumbent's reelection strategy rather than the community that person's seeking to represent. That's the nut of the problem. It's led to uncompetitive elections. It's led to hyper-partisanship. It's led to primaries being the only thing that matters. It's led to all sorts of things that are not good, I think, tear at the threads of our republic. Ideal redistricting looks like what they did in California or what we should see this coming cycle in Michigan and Colorado. That's an independent commission with balances of party members in, independent of the legislature, not independent, like not a Republican or Democrat. All the good commissions have R's and D's on them in balanced ways. And it has a supermajority vote requirement and transparency and all those things. So that's the ideal. Virginia's districts are very far away from that. We are incredibly far away from that right now. So to say this amendment does better is a bit of a low bar, but I do think it's about a B and we're at an F right now.
Chris, you want to speak to that?
There really is no ideal system. You can only strive for it. You know, you're never going to get a perfect system. But I think that what Brian described is you know the best kind of system you can get. Getting it independent of the legislature. You know, as long as legislators are involved in the process. I mean, actually, I shouldn't say that. I don't even have a problem with them involved in the process as long as they don't control the process. This amendment leaves legislators in control of the process, and no, unmistakably, they are completely in control of the process. I mean, for example, the sponsor of this amendment has a district that is one of the craziest gerrymanders in the state, and he wants this amendment so that he can retain that kind of control over his district. So, I mean, that's the fundamental problem, and I would give this. You know, when it's talking about grading, I would give this a D minus. I probably wouldn't fail it. I'd give it a D minus. But most of the, you know, I see Brian did give it a B. Most of the advocates, I think, to be honest, if they're being honest, they would give it a C or a C minus, or, you know, even the advocates.
Okay. All right. Thanks. We have a question from Vicki Jones. Can either speaker describe how the 8 members of the General Assembly and 8 citizens of the Commonwealth would be chosen? It sounded like from earlier comments that the 8 citizens would be selected by the 8 chosen General Assembly members, but how would those 8 General Assembly members be selected? Who wants to take that? Chris?
Okay. They're not chosen by the they're chosen by the party leaders. So they're chosen by the leaders of the Democratic leader in the House and the majority leader and the minority leader in the House and the Senate. That's who picks them. And it's presumed that those would be the same people who are actually the sitting legislators. Or four of the sitting legislators. So in a sense, it may be the same people who are on the commission. But the point is, the leadership, the party leadership, picks the citizens. And I mean, that's basically the answer to that.
So in Virginia, we have the problem. I think it's a good thing, but other states that have had reform, they register by party. I hope everybody listening to this is registered to vote, but I know you were not registered as a Republican or a Democrat, right? So identifying citizens to serve who are Republicans and Democrats to make sure you have an equal balance of them is a little bit tricky because I'm personally a Democrat, but you could look at my voting history and see that in 2016, I voted in the Republican presidential primary because I thought John Kasich would be a better candidate to have against my preferred candidate, Hillary Clinton. But so we run everything through to identify the folks, and this is something we learned from California, to identify who's on what team. One of the things that California's executive director of Common Cause, who helped get it done there, said is politicians are really good at finding out, at doing opposition research, finding out who's for them and who's against them. So we run everything through the 4 legislative leaders. We know who that'll be. It'll be Senator Louise Lucas, who's the Senate pro tem. It'll be Speaker Eileen Fillerkorn, obviously Speaker of the House. And on the Republican side, it'll be Senator Tommy Norman. and Delegate Todd Gilbert. And they will each get to pick two members of their caucus to serve as the legislative side. And then they each have to recommend a list of 16 eligible people to serve on the commission. That group of 64 people total will be filtered down through the judge selection committee.
Thanks. I want to ask a question, though, a little bit related to that. So this excludes pretty much citizens who are independents. They're not going to end up on these lists, right? And yet you look at any poll in the U.S. these days, something like 40% of voters identify themselves as independents. How much of a flaw or failure is it that those people are likely to be unrepresented in if this amendment passes? Brian, you want to speak to that?
Yeah, so the chair of the Libertarian Party of Virginia has been a friend of mine. His name's Bo Brown, and Bo gives me a lot of crap about that very problem. He's like, where's the space for the non-Democrats and Republicans? And he still supports this, by the way, but let me say that in gerrymandering, and the thing that I've told Bo is that there's no way to gerrymander a district for or against the Libertarian Party. There just isn't. There's not enough of them. You can't draw them out. You can gerrymander a district for or against one of the two major parties, and that's the whole point. But again, I think this is the, do you compare the proposed reform to the status quo, or do you compare the proposed reform to an ideal, like a platonic ideal that we don't have on the table right now? And yes, in the platonic ideal, you have space for non-two majority party people on the commission. But right now, the process would also be controlled by just Democrats and Republicans in the status quo. So this doesn't necessarily move the ball too much further on that.
Thanks. Chris, do you want to speak to that?
Yeah, I think that that is one of the other concerns. It does cut independents out of the process. But the reality is, and Brian, I think, alluded to that, the reality is that in our system here, the issue of gerrymandering, when you're talking about partisan gerrymandering, is you have to deal with the two major parties that are behind it. And you can't really solve this without without taking that into consideration. That doesn't mean, though, that the party leadership who are sitting in the legislature should be calling the shots in this. I do think you need some type of balance. But there's other ways to do it, too. It's interesting. There's other ways to give independents some you know, leverage and all. I mean, for example, I point out the New Jersey system, which is very similar to this system. It's got some differences. And the thing that a lot of people like to point out is the fact that they're all legislators on there, not just legislators and people picked by legislators. But if they have a tie, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court appoints an independent citizen to break the tie. So even though there's very little citizen participation, that's a significant difference. And that citizen actually has some influence and is picked independently and is an independent. So as flawed as their system is and as bad as they want to change it, it's actually probably a little better than ours than what's being proposed here.
All right. Thanks. Let's see, we've treated this a little bit already. Tom Cross asks, how would the commission decide on what an ideal district looks like? What metrics would they use? Demographics, party preference, gender makeup, ethnic makeup, et cetera. Chris?
Well, ideally, you look at things that are, you know, certainly not party. You don't want to be considering party data. You look at certain things, certain criteria like compactness, contiguous. You look at, there's some people who feel you should make districts as competitive as possible, do them with a computer model and things like that, based on competitiveness. But then again, you don't want to separate it from the community too much either. So there's communities of interest. So you come up with these different, in a good process, which this doesn't really do. It leaves it to the criteria legislation. But a good amendment, and you can't write every single detail into an amendment. I get that, but you would put a ranking criteria on things like compactness, contiguousness, communities of interest. But you have to define that. You could define that level of detail could be in legislation, things like that. And that's what you really want to do. You want to try and keep the politics out of as much as possible. And that's what the enabling and the criteria legislation did, and that's good. But you need some guardrails in the amendment itself. Otherwise, your criteria legislation could be written to give the majority party an advantage.
Thanks. Brian.
There's two scenarios here for Democrats. Is that one is that they keep power and can continue to fix this. Because I do believe in the 80-20 rule here. 80% of Democrats really do want independent redistricting. 20% don't. The inverse, I think, is true for my Republican friends in the legislature. 20% want reform and 80% don't. The option here for, like, is it going to happen in the future? Are there criteria that could be pulled back is important to think about. If Democrats are in charge, then I believe they'll have the votes to keep making progress if we get this amendment in place and get rid of partisan gerrymandering and get rid of the smoky back room. If Democrats are not in charge and Republicans are in charge, even though Republicans would be able to write their own criteria, Democrats would still be able to, on this commission structure, because of the supermajority requirement, which is different than New Jersey's, because of the supermajority requirement, Democrats would be able to block bad maps.
All right, thanks. We've touched on this, but would both of you please comment, why specifically is the Virginia Legislative Black Caucus really opposed to this amendment? What would need to be changed to remove that opposition, do you think? Brian, would you speak to that?
Sure. The Virginia Legislative Black Caucus is not against the amendment. All four black state senators voted for this and pushed very, very hard for it. Senator Locke, Senator Lucas, and Senator McClellan in particular. The House Legislative Black Caucus, the members of the House who were in the Virginia Legislative Black Caucus, do oppose this, except one of them, Delegate Sam Rasool, who's the treasurer for the VLBC. From a perspective of an African-American voter here in Virginia or an African-American citizen in Virginia, I think everybody who is African-American has an absolute right to be skeptical of the status quo or of any redistricting reform whatsoever. And I don't begrudge anybody for that. But I will say that when I hear legislators oppose this and I look to what a lot of the members of the House Black Caucus, including Lamont Bagby, who was the chair of this, proposed in 2018, when there was a remedial map for the House of Delegates, turns out they proposed a partisan and racial gerrymander as well. And that was that's current day Democrats. So I was incredibly disappointed by that and don't trust, black legislators, white legislators, brown, and anybody to do the right thing. I think you've got to build this system of checks and balances here.
Sure. Chris?
Yeah, I think the House Legislative Caucus is they're the ones that oppose it. And I think that they just want more explicit protections in there. As Brian mentioned, the line in there about enabling, I don't have the exact line, but enabling districts to be drawn that allow a community to elect a candidate of their choice. That is specifically in there, but it doesn't really deal with racial gerrymandering. It's a different issue. I mean, you can interpret that as an excuse to pack. I know that we're a practical language, but it can actually be used as an excuse to pack them in too. So it doesn't really deal with it adequately. I don't know the exact fix for that, but that's their concern. That's why the NAACP has come out against it as well. The other thing is, in general, in the Senate, you see more support for it, whether black, white, whatever, you see more support for it. Because senators, House districts are relatively compact. They're not as much of a gerrymander. I mean, a lot of these senators need to gerrymander to hold on to the seat, including the sponsor of the amendment. So that's why you see this different dynamic between the Senate and the House. Whether that translates into an impossibility to get an independent commission, which is a different discussion, and Brian and I disagree on that, is another thing. But that's the main thing, is that they don't feel it has enough protections in there, and they would like more explicit language rather than just referring to existing legislation. They want explicit language in the amendment.
Thank you. Sue Lewis says, can citizens apply to serve? Do they apply to the leadership? What's the answer to that, Chris? If it passes, if the amendment passes.
I'm not even aware if there's an application process per se. I mean, that's the kind of thing that should be in an amendment like this. It should be, there should be an application process where anyone can apply and they submit their qualifications. It's reviewed by an independent panel and so on and so forth. They cannot have any connection to the legislature, not a lobbyist, nothing like that. That's what there should be. I don't think, and Brian may correct me, I don't think there's any kind of a process. You just have the leadership of the two parties saying who they want to be on, who they want the judges to pick from to be on this commission. That's it. But I mean, maybe Brian can add more to that.
Yeah. So, you know, Chris and I agree on the ultimate goal that lobbyists, to former legislature, all that shouldn't serve. That would be ideal to keep off. But I do disagree that we should put the application process in the constitutional amendment. That's a little bit nitty gritty administrative law that I'm not sure, at least in Virginia's constitutional model of creating structures and framework and then having enabling legislation fill things in, which is the way we do it in Virginia. It doesn't fit that model. Whether we should change that or not is a different story, but it doesn't fit that model. So we're not going to have an application through the Constitution in there. But there is enabling legislation that was on the table that Senator Lucas carried that passed both the Senate and the House with bipartisan majorities. It went to a conference committee in March over a few wording changes that needed to be made. And then, and this is what's ironic, is that Delegate Marcus Simon and Delegate Sia Price, two people on the board with Chris on the Vote No campaign, opposed the whole compromise. They said no way, no how, and they threw it all out. So we don't have any enabling legislation because, and they both said it to the papers, they preferred to have the amendment stand on its own and not do the enabling legislation. Basically, they're playing politics with it instead of policy. The good news is that the Senate members this time in the special session put that enabling legislation back into the budget. It's in the budget in the Senate right now. And if the House approves it, the governor signs it, it becomes law immediately. We will have an application process with extra filters on who can be selected and serve. That would be great. But the problem, ironically, is the Vote No side of the House House Democratic Caucus has been blocking it for 7 months now.
Comment to that, Chris, or not? No.
Yeah, I would say I'm not suggesting every step-by-step part of the application process being the Constitution. What I'm saying is the Constitution amendment just has to say something like any citizen will be able to apply, they're independent, and so on, and legislation will be passed to lay out the exact process, something to that effect. Right now, the amendment itself is silent on it, and so, you know, enabling legislation is great, but, you know, that can just disappear and so on. And the other thing to remember is the current selection process, which is crazy, is probably, I might be wrong, but I think it's probably the most involved, takes up the most text in the whole amendment, is this long, elaborate process of how the leadership gets to pick X number of names and submit them to retired. It's probably a quarter of the whole amendment. And it really, in the end, could just say the leadership of the parties picked these people. It could really do that and would have the same result yet. So you know, that's just my comment on that.
Chris, would you agree that the House should pass the enabling legislation that's in the budget now?
Absolutely.
Okay. I don't know. You should tell Delegate Price that.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with it. I haven't looked at the latest version, but I mean, in general, we need enabling legislation for this if it passes. Just like if it doesn't pass, we need a commission, because I don't agree that if it doesn't pass, that the legislature just is free to draw the districts. There is legislation. Yes, they could theoretically repeal their own legislation, but there is legislation on the books. Nothing to deal with the commission. I agree, because that failed. But the criteria legislation does guide them, and we need legislation to pass to handle how the commission is picked, regardless of whether the amendment passes or not.
I wanted to ask, Chris, related to that, suppose your side wins. In other words, the amendment fails. What happens next year and the year after that? Look into the future a little bit. Is there any hope?
Yeah. I mean, there's a couple of things. First, what would happen next year, 2021? There's no question that there's not as many guardrails on the legislature if there's not an amendment in place. I mean, you know, I'd be lying if I didn't say that. But the reality is that SB 1255 does put guardrails in place. But it is only legislation. Brian's absolutely right. I mean, the same people who passed it last year could decide to just repeal it and say, heck, we're not going to follow it. That's kind of unlikely. The other thing to keep in mind is that the worst gerrymandering occurs when a party faces an existential threat, when the party is in retreat. You know, that happened with the Democrats in the 1980s. It's happened with Republicans now. When if you don't cheat on the districts, you are going to lose seats. That is actually not the situation. That's the unique situation we have right now. It's not the situation right now. Population shifts probably mean that Democrats are probably going to be okay, maybe pick up a couple seats if just fair districts are drawn. So the idea that the same people who passed this and have been advocating for real reform, just acknowledge he thinks 80% of the Democrats support an independent commission, even more reform than this. So the idea that those people are now going to come back and repeal their own legislation so that they can squeeze a couple more districts when they're probably going to do okay in a fair district situation is not credible. I think we can get through the 2021 process fine. And then the question is, what do we do for the next phase? And that is to push real hard on a constitutional amendment that really does independent redistricting. Hopefully we get it on the ballot no later than 2024, because we cannot wait until the last minute. Because if legislators are voting on this when next year they are up for it's not the right situation. It's got to be done early. The people around now who are the biggest naysayers, the sponsors, these people won't even be in office in 10 years. I think we can get a better amendment through, but that'll never happen if this passes, because everyone will declare victory, walk away, and we'll be just like New Jersey.
Although if that happened in 2024, there's no activity then until 2031, right?
That's true.
So it lies dormant, more or less.
Well, I mean, two things. You don't want to wait until the last minute to try to pass something like this, because this is the problem. I mean, you've got people looking at their job security next year. When it's 10 years off, it's a little easier to do it. Some of these people will figure that they may not even be there. So that's one reason to do it as early as possible. The other thing is you want to deal with, as Brian points out all the time, you want to deal with, there's no right now prohibition on mid-cycle redistricting. So there's some danger, of course, that the Republicans will take it before that. But that's a risk I'm willing to take, because this amendment is just too flawed. So you do want that done as soon as possible.
Yeah. All right. Thanks. Brian, suppose that the amendment passes. It's not perfect by any means. What's your forecast for the future in terms of whether things could be improved?
I'm optimistic by definition of the fact that I took this job 5.5 years ago at all, right, and was willing to get into this fight. But I am not that optimistic that we get an independent commission. I really don't think we're there, especially not in 2024, maybe closer to the end of this coming decade. But I don't think the votes are there now. There's probably about 10 to 15 House Democrats that just don't believe in independent redistricting. And the problem is, and I think Delegate Hudson had a really good quote where she said today in the Virginia Mercury, because what's hard about the politics right now, people who want more reform and people who want no reform, she said none, can come together to oppose the amendment, but they can't come together on an alternative. And I think that's really where we are right now, is that there's a couple wolves in sheep's clothing in the Democratic caucuses that are pushing against this for the wrong reasons. That being said, no legislature has ever gone from 0 to 60 in this, right? No legislature, unilateral party control, has ever said, you know what, we're going to do a complete independent commission. That hasn't happened. This is the most redistricting reform to ever get through a state legislature without the threat of a citizens initiative. That's huge. And I do think that if we want an independent commission in the long run, the road to get there runs through a vote yes on this amendment.
And isn't it right, just a comment, you mentioned California as an exemplary nonpartisan commission, redistricting and so forth. But in California is both a blessing and an evil. They can do things like that by simply having referenda, right? They don't have to amend the Constitution.
Well, they do amend their constitution, but they do it through a citizens referendum, like you said. Yeah, I think it takes like five people to sign in the back of a napkin, and then people vote on it. It's in the constitution.
That also led to Proposition 13 or something, right?
Yeah. They get like a phone book every year on constitutional amendments because of that. I'm not recommending Virginia go that route, but it would be a lot easier to get independent redistricting if we did.
All right. We have another, still looking for questions from the audience. We have another one from Tom Cross. It says, such a great discussion, and without concrete criteria to judge success and failure of the commission, it becomes a lot of hand waving that leads to a muddle, ? And government must have metrics of success to be meaningful. Well, I'm not sure we need to comment on that. That's probably true. Chris, any comment to that?
As far as whether we need metrics of success, I mean, it's tough, but to do this, because a lot of this, you know, every reform is a little different, so you don't really know how it's going to work. But like I keep saying, the closest thing we can look at is New Jersey. And so if you look at that, it doesn't tell a good story. And that's why, you know, do we want to really take that chance? I do believe that there can be reform. Brian might be right about 10 or a dozen Democrats in the House that don't want the reform, but most do. And Republicans typically don't. In this environment, you will get a significant number of Republicans who will for the first time come out for independent redistricting in this environment. So I think there is the right environment for a better bill. And I also, as much as I commend Brian's commitment to this, I think that all the donors for these organizations will dry up as soon as they get an amendment passed to declare victory, and the pressure of the lobbyists will go away. If this is defeated by the voters, there will be intense pressure to get something done, and the resources will continue because there'll be a significant grassroots activity on it, and the money will continue, and I think we'll get something much better through.
Brian?
So I'd agree on the metrics thing, Tom. I think you're absolutely right. I think that's why in the criteria there should be metrics for minimizing locality splits. Basically, you shouldn't be carving up, you know, municipalities like they do in the current system to do this. The problem with that is that Democrats falsely believe that hurts their chances of winning. So they prefer communities of interest, which is a very vague term, over minimizing split localities. Republicans, because they falsely think it benefits them, prefer it the other way. Professor Moon Duchin at Tufts University has got a supercomputer and a group of mathematicians that are focused exclusively on gerrymandering. They've done work in Pennsylvania, North Carolina, a bunch of municipalities around the country. They're experts in this. And the funny thing is that they say that Virginia is such an outlier because our Democratic votes aren't quite packed. If you think about a place like Georgia, where, you know, all the Democrats live in Atlanta and the burbs and everything else is deep red, you know, Virginia's not like that. And so we could do the municipality split thing without any negative partisan gerrymandering, and that would be something you could measure. But unfortunately, it's not. But what I do think the good news is that with the open data and open meeting provisions of this amendment, is that we'll actually be able to get folks like Moon Duchin in real time evaluating these maps as they come out, and they can plot them on their kind of supercomputer chart showing kind of the bell curve of what you could expect if you did A, B, C, and D. So they've got some real watchdog capabilities there if this thing is done in the open.
Okay. Thanks. Thank you. We're just about at the end of our hour. I want to ask, and I don't see more questions coming in from the audience, so maybe we ought to wrap this up, but we ought to do that by this time, Chris. We'll ask Chris to make a last argument that we should vote no on this amendment. And you can take up to 4 minutes to do that. And then we'll ask Brian to tell us again why we should do this. So, Chris, would you go ahead?
Okay. So, I mean, the basic concern that I have, obviously, as I've stated, is that it leaves legislators in control of the process. I mean, that's the bottom line. So you got to keep thinking of independent. We need something independent, and you know, maybe it'll never get perfect. I'm not looking for perfection. I'm not looking for keeping the legislators totally out. I don't even care if they're part of the process. It'd be nice if they weren't, but you know, I don't have a problem. I have a problem with them controlling the process, and that's what this amendment does. So if you don't want politicians picking the voters rather than the other way around, you don't want this amendment, because that's what this amendment does. And then there's the transparency issue is important. And so Brian has alluded to that, and transparency is great. And I think I saw a question before that somebody asked about how does that change the process? What does transparency do? And it's always good. More transparency is always good. But anybody who feels that that's going to transform, that people are not going to gerrymander just because they're now required to gerrymander in plain sight, is mistaken. Politicians do stupid, unpopular things all the time. Politicians will, you just have to look at our Supreme Court situation right now. Look at the Republicans and how they are flip-flopping on that Supreme Court issue. I mean, it's embarrassing to them how ridiculous it is, and it's putting their hold in, you know, their ability to win elections in jeopardy. It's terrible. Yet it's as transparent as heck, and 98% of the country is paying attention to it, yet they're still doing it. And so the idea that because something as obscure as redistricting that 99% of the country doesn't pay any attention to, that a politician is going to agree to draw a fair district that might put them out of a job because 1% of the population is paying attention to it, is just crazy. It's important. Transparency is important, but it's not going to have any effect on whether districts are gerrymandered or not.
All right. Thank you, Chris. Brian, why should we vote yes?
So this commission, on its worst day, ends partisan gerrymandering and adds transparency to the process, right? Even if all of the commissioners are nothing but party hacks and everything that Chris fears, and that I fear too, even if that's the case, there's still balances and a balance of them and checks on each other. And it's not like New Jersey. New Jersey doesn't have a supermajority requirement, which is one of its biggest problems. You would have to get serious buy-in from that. So even on its worst day, it takes us a huge step forward by destroying the smoky back room and ending partisan gerrymandering. Now, is that all we need to do? Of course not. And Linda, I see your comments here, and I wish you'd gone ahead and asked the question. But you know, she said that saying that minority folks can be at the table is a far cry from saying they will be at the table. I would agree; it should be in there. But I will say that there's two ways to accomplish a lot of these goals. One is to write it down on either in the Code of Virginia or in the state constitution. The other is to create structures that generate the outcomes you're looking for. And in this case, we have a structure that very much generates it, because half of the commission is going to be appointed directly or indirectly by Senator Louise Lucas and Speaker Eileen Fillercorn. So the idea that we won't get black and brown voices on this commission is absurd. Of course they're going to appoint people like that. And if we wanted to guarantee it, and Linda, I hope you agree, if we wanted to guarantee this, they should pass that enabling legislation right now. But the people who have killed it are the vote no people, because they're trying to make a political play here at the expense of good policy. And I don't care about the politics of this. I just want good policy. They should pass it right now. And that's why I doubt their sincerity on whether they want true redistricting reform, is because they're blocking, and they have blocked, legislation that I think would take this commission from a B to a B+. And so if you're looking at who you should trust in this, who you should listen to, like I said, you don't have to listen to me. Don't listen to any delegate or senator in Virginia. Just skip all of that. But look at the folks that have fought for this redistricting reform in red states and blue states all over the country. I'm talking about Common Cause, Campaign Legal Center, the Brennan Center for Justice, and the Princeton Gerrymandering Project, as well as Dave Daley, who wrote the book on the whole matter, right? Like, look at those experts, and they all uniformly say, this is a big step forward, take it, and we can get more later.
Thank you. Thank you, Brian. Thank you, Chris. You've helped us really understand this more profoundly than we had before. It's a complicated, it isn't black or white issue. There are pluses and minuses and so forth, and you both have helped us to really get our arms around this better than before. So much appreciated. We're going to end that here. I want to put in a little ad for advertisement for the next Senior Statesman of Virginia program. It's on November 11th, and it's about the new encompassing Virginia Clean Economy Act. And the speakers will be from the Virginia Department of Mines, Minerals, and Energy, which within the executive branch has overall responsibility for setting the goals and for seeing to the implementation of the act. So that should be a good meeting, November the 11th, same time, same place, Zoom, 1:30 to 2:30 p.m. So thanks, everybody.